Hi, I'm Anna Partridge, and today I'm speaking with the internationally renowned slow parenting coach and journalist all the way from London, Carl Honoré. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you very much.
You recently filmed a documentary here in Australia called Frantic Family Rescue that aired on SBS a few weeks ago, and it was brilliant. For those of you who haven't yet watched it, can you just tell us a little bit about the concept of what you were doing here?
Sure. Well, I'm guessing that most of your audience will have heard of the show Super Nanny.
Yes.
The shorthand I have for describing my show is to think of it as Slow Nanny. So I guess I had one month to go into homes where families were turning every moment of the day into a race against the clock. They were constantly juggling stuff. Everything was a dash to the finish line. They just felt overwrought, overscheduled, and frazzled. The title of the program is Frantic Family Rescue. So I had a month to help them put on the brakes, to give them a taste of what it would be like to step off that high-speed treadmill and to move towards a more balanced approach to family life.
Which is very relevant at the moment.
Absolutely, and around the world as well. This is a global phenomenon. The parents, families, children everywhere find themselves caught up in this, or infected by this virus of hurry, if you like, where every single moment seems to be about doing something, and especially doing something that will look good on a CV or a resume.
And at the start of the show, you mentioned that Australia has a persona for being a laid-back and relaxed culture, but you obviously found the opposite when you came out here.
I certainly did among the families that I work with, and others as well. It is funny that Australia definitely has a reputation for being very relaxed. You know, we think of beaches, Barbies, beers, and all that. And of course, Australia does have that vibe to it. But I think the country has also been swept up. A lot of families have been in the same global parenting moment, which is that for a lot of Australian families, just as a lot of families where I live here in London or in North America, come from Canada, same thing across Europe, where for a lot of families, parenting has become a cross between a competitive sport and product development. And that's very often not what we wanted as parents, but somehow we woke up one day and that's what family life had become, even in Australia.
Sure, but obviously parents think they're doing the best for their children by enrolling them in all these extracurricular activities, develop their strengths and provide them with opportunity. And one family you even worked with over here had their child in 16 extra activities a week, which seems a lot. So what's your advice for finding that sort of balance between developing the child and finding the family balance?
Well, the key word here is balance. You do want to expose your child to as many opportunities and activities as possible. It's almost a throw to the wall and see what sticks approach, I think. You let them try lots of different sports. You encourage them to delve into music and the arts and whatever it is that grabs their fancy. And even if it doesn't grab their fancy, because they may not know what their fancy is until they're actually exposed to something. So I think it's important to put them out there and enroll them, but then to monitor the child's reaction and to work out whether that activity really means anything to the kid. And if it doesn't, if it's not going to stick in the long term, and if it's not essential, like swimming, I think is a very important thing for everybody to learn, for instance, then I think you want to look at just letting it go and focusing on the activities that really put fire in that child's belly. Because if you don't, you'll end up with a scenario like one of the families in the program where one child is doing more than a dozen activities, which clearly is too much. I think most parents, even though it's hard to hang a firm number on how many activities is right, because I think it varies from age group to age group, from family to family, because every family is different. I mean, every family has its own natural metronome and its own comfortable tempo and pace. And so for one family, three or four extracurriculars for the kids might be just fine, but for another, one or two is going to work better. But for most, I think as a general rule, 16 is going to be too much.
And you know, if you've got multiple children and they're all doing extracurricular activities, it seems like it's a pretty fast-paced week that you're going to be running to.
Well, that's, of course, the other thing. Once you go beyond one child, then, of course, you're adding, layering on other activities and more logistics and getting from A to B and back again. So you have to take that into account as well. I think it's going to be easier probably to get more extracurriculars comfortably and sensibly into the activity schedule of one kid than it is if you've got two or three. So you've got to balance all those things off and think about what kind of family life you want to have. And remember that so much of the best and richest experience for a child happens outside of organized activities. When they're not on the clock, they're not being monitored, they're not being benchmarked or evaluated, they're not doing anything that could ever appear on a university application form or a CV. They're just being kids, right? They're just playing freely with adults out of the way. And I think that's so important to defend that free play. Like what William Blake, the English poet, once described childhood as seeing a world in a grain of sand and holding infinity in the palm of your hand, that extraordinary capacity children have to disappear into a moment and let their imaginations run wild. And we know from science now that in those moments of free play, when there are no tests, no targets, and no timetables, we know that children, when they interact with the world around them at their own pace, they're allowed to follow the North Star of their own curiosity, that their brains are in that moment are on fire, right? They're building their brains in ways that 1,000 hours of Kumon tutoring and 1,000 educational DVDs and 1,000 extracurricular activities will never come close to touching. So it's important to defend those seeing a world in a grain of sand moments, those Blakean moments of childhood, and blend them together with something more structured and something more formalized, like extracurriculars, and finding the right equilibrium that works for your child and your family.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that analogy. So you talk a lot about hyper-parenting, and I call it the hurry-up culture that we've slipped into as parents. For parents who are listening, what are sort of three key elements that you look at as hyper-parenting?
Well, I sort of feel that there are symptoms or signs that are a signal that we are falling into the hyper-parenting or the hurry-up parenting or the fast parenting track. And one of those, if you find yourself at sporting events shouting yourself hoarse or getting into arguments with referees, coaches, and other parents at your kids' games, then I think you're probably going down that track. If your children are falling asleep in the backseat of the car en route to extracurricular activities, you may be falling into overload. If you're yanking your kid out of one activity early to get to the next one on time, ditto. If the only books you ever read are parenting manuals, or your only topic of conversation in adult company is your own children and what they're up to, then I think that might be a sign that you're parenting too hard. And also if you find yourself constantly comparing your children with their peers, or you never feel like you're ever doing enough for your kids, then that can also be a sign that you're falling into this excessive parenting trap. And of course, I don't want to demonize parents. You know, I'm a parent myself. I have two kids. I know exactly how this works. We want the best for our children. But the trouble is that noble and natural instinct has, over the last generation, morphed into a caricature of itself. So that now as parents, whether we like it or not, or whether we even notice it or not, we feel this immense pressure to push, polish, and protect our kids with superhuman zeal. We feel we've got to give them the best of everything and at the same time make them the best at everything. And the irony, of course, is that by parenting so hard, we end up backfiring on our kids and we don't deliver the kind of childhood that I think we all want for our children, which is to give them that space and time to explore the world on their own terms, to learn how to make mistakes, to be resilient, to get along with their peers, to work out who they are rather than what everyone else wants them to be. So by dialing down the pressure of giving children that time and space, I think we can allow our children to find the best version of themselves, to find their better angels, if you like.
And so that leads me into my next question is, as you know, I'm writing my book on the art of raising a resilient child, and so I'm particularly interested in how you think this style of parenting or over-parenting or hyper-parenting is affecting our children's ability to bounce back from situations or to be resilient. So you mentioned that, you know, a generation ago, and so probably when we were kids, I mean, I know myself, I had a very different upbringing to the upbringing my children have. We were almost free-ranged as children, and, you know, I know that we've certainly gone quite the other way here. But how do you think that is actually impacting on the resilience of our children?
Well, I definitely think that our children's resilience is being sacrificed on the altar of this smothering hyper helicopter approach to parenting, definitely, because the one thing that you want children to come out with at the end of their childhood is to be able to stand on their own two feet and be resilient. And that is not what's happening anymore. Because we are mollycoddling, wrapping our children in plastic sheet or, you know, cotton wool, we're raising them almost in captivity. We're not allowing them to run any risks at all. They're not learning how to make mistakes and how to deal with the emotional and physical fallout from screwing up and getting up, finding the strength, the internal strength, to stand up again after a mistake or a mishap and dust yourself down and get on with that without turning to mommy or daddy for help or a grown-up to to do it for you. And I think this is one of the great disservices we're doing to the next generation, is not allowing them that, what Virginia Woolf described childhood as, that great cathedral space. And we have that. You described it there as well. You talked about a free-range childhood. I think of that as very much the way most children have always grown up until the last generation, having that incredible freedom to go out, run risks, learn how to deal with risks, make mistakes, and to get stronger gradually at their own pace, rather than being kept in a gilded cage and then suddenly unleashed on the world at the age of 18 to go to university, where, of course, they can't cope. And this is something you see around the world now. Universities and colleges are reporting that in record numbers, first-year, second-year kids are just falling apart emotionally. They just cannot cope. They haven't got the wherewithal, because suddenly, having been raised in this bubble of overprotectiveness, they finally find themselves out in the real world, and they do not have the resilience and the wherewithal and the emotional internal reservoir to cope. And so they end up falling back on either falling apart or falling back on some kind of medication, or again turning to the grown-up world to bail them out. And I think if we would allow ourselves to take our foot off the accelerator pedal and just back off and let them get on with it, then I think children would emerge far more resilient. Even simple things like letting them climb trees. You know, everybody is so afraid of letting children climb trees nowadays. In fact, in Britain, I saw a statistic that really summed this up. It showed that children now in Britain are three times more likely to get hurt falling out of bed than falling out of a tree, because no one allows their kids to climb trees anymore because it's too dangerous. And yet another statistic that came out roughly at the same time showed that successful entrepreneurs, as you know, people who are really lighting up the startup world, 80 to 85% of them were inveterate tree climbers as kids growing up.
Okay.
Obviously, why? You know, because they took those risks. They were able to look up into the complex matrix of all those branches and figure out the path up. And if they fell, they got hurt, but they got up again. And all that stuff that we're constantly saying as politicians, teachers, parents, business people, we want children to be able to do these things. But then when it comes to how we raise them, we don't allow them to learn those skills. So there's a kind of weird disconnect going on that I think we can feel intuitively is happening. And because of that, as a natural optimist, I think we'll turn it around. And in fact, we are looking and now increasingly finding ways to back off and let children have that childhood that allows them to grow up strong, resilient, and, you know, tremendously good citizens.
And so in your Frantic Family Rescue, you gave some pretty simple steps for the families to be able to slow down the pace of their lives and to be able to find these cathedral moments of childhood. What were your sort of main takeouts from that?
Well, it was an awful lot, obviously, and each family was different. That's something to remember as well, that there's no one-size-fits-all recipe. You don't walk in with a tablet of stone and say, here are the 10 things that every family must do, and you will reconnect with your inner tortoise and be a perfect poster slow family tomorrow. Excuse me, if only it were that simple. I think you start off by making the bigger meta case for putting on the brakes and doing less and focusing on what's important. And then you start looking for little hacks and tips. Technology, let's start off there. I mean, all of the families we dealt with were, like many families nowadays, just over-plugged in. You know, they were distracted. They couldn't switch people off. The kids were on the screens all the time. So I came down quite hard in the program on that and instituted a ban, really, for that month on gadgets, right? Just to give people a flavor for what it would be like to have a home, to live together in a way where they weren't constantly distracted by WhatsApp, Xbox, and their Twitter feed. So I had a gadget box where everybody had to put their mobile gadgets into the front door and took away the TVs or covered up the screens and so on and let them get on with that, which they found a bit of a jolt at first, but I was amazed by how, actually, that was something all three families really, really rallied around. And particularly one of the families that had particular trouble with one of the boy who was a real Xbox guy, really made a big change there, which was quite...
And was that the little boy at the end who said, I don't want to play it anymore, I want to go out and kick the footy with my friends? Was that that?
Exactly. Thing? And that was so thrilling to me, because we're always being told that this is a lost generation, we've lost them to screens, but we haven't. Mm-hmm. If we just have the guts and the imagination and the courage to step in and say, you know what... This is too much. We're going to switch off. But of course, you can't just leave them there with a blank screen. You've got to say at first, well, look, why don't you, instead of playing FIFA football on the Xbox, why don't you go with the real football and find that little boy across the street who's the same age as you, whom you never see, and go kick it around in the park, in the corner, or in the back garden, and just help them with that transitional phase. And, if, you know, children are hardwired for that other kind of play that doesn't involve screens, which involves their running around, falling over and scraping their knee, negotiating rules with, you know, friends and pick up informal games of football or soccer or whatever they're playing outside. So they will immediately or pretty quickly fall back into the joys of that if you nudge them towards it. And I found that the whole tech thing fascinating, how that make a change for the families. And that was great to see. But the tech was just the start. I think we had to look also at people's schedules and start just pruning, you know, cutting things back, opening up empty, unscheduled time, and also scheduling, in a sense, unscheduled time, setting aside and ring-fencing off a couple of hours here on a Sunday where you don't plan anything in advance, and then you arrive at that time, and you've got time, actually, which is so unusual nowadays, to do with whatever you feel like, so you can be spontaneous and have moments of serendipity, because you're not scheduled up to the eyeball. So I think that was important as well.
And children live so much in the moment, you know, it's so important, isn't it, to meet them in that moment of joy.
It is. And if you're constantly running around with a schedule in one hand and your iPhone in the other, you don't ever have the moment, because you're constantly juggling several moments at once. And that was a big part as well of what I tried to do with the families, was to almost force upon them or impose upon them those kind of Blakean moments of seeing a world in a grain of sand, where things weren't happening at 100 miles an hour, and you could just slide into the moment, either alone or together. So having something, the one thing that worked really well in all the families and works very well in my own home is having a puzzle, a very big puzzle, somewhere on the kitchen table or somewhere in the house. It's just there that people can sit down at and put a few pieces in, or sit down together and chat over, or do the puzzle in companionable silence. And it's just a very slow ritual that injects a different rhythm into the household and gets people away from all that racing and striving and CV building that we tend to find ourselves doing, even if it's maybe not what we necessarily want to do all the time. It just seems to be what we end up doing. So if you can put those things, embed them physically in the home and physically in the schedule, I think that can be helpful as well too.
Brilliant. That was a brilliant interview. I'm really enjoying our chat. You've got some great advice there to slow down. One thing before you go is, why do you think we have changed so much in that generation? I mean, you mentioned technology, but do you have any other insights into why, you know, we might have changed so much in our parenting style in that generation?
Yes. I think that we've stumbled into a unique moment in the history of parenting and childhood for a number of reasons. A number of historical and social trends have intersected together to create a perfect storm. I think the coming down of the Berlin Wall and the globalization of the world economy has created a more competitive environment. So parents feel they've got to push really hard to prepare their kids to get ahead, to survive even in this cutthroat world. I think also the changes demographically, we're having children older now than ever before, and that makes a big difference, especially since we're having smaller families. We know from all the research done around the world, especially in China, that the fewer children you have, the more anxious you are about each child. And then if you have children older, I think we come to the parenting game with a different ethos. We've spent many years in the workplace. We come into the home to start having children. We bring a lot of that workplace culture with us. And we think, well, how do I parent better? I'll do what I do at work. You know, I'll invest a lot of energy, put a lot of money in, consult a lot of experts.
Sure.
You know, I'll professionalize parenting. And I think there's a lot of guilt as well at play. Parents, and especially, of course, this naturally tends to be more mothers, find themselves maybe giving up a big, high-flying, high-pressure career, suddenly find themselves at home and think, well, ugh, what do I do? And they look at their child and think, well, there's my new project. And so a lot of that energy gets poured into the child, and they find it harder just to let things happen, because that's not what you do at work. You don't just let things happen. You get in. You're proactive. And I think that spirit comes back to us in the home now. I think also you mentioned technology. Technology has made us expect things to happen at the speed of software and increased our general impatience, so that's part of it too. And then also the consumerist culture has really ratcheted up over the last generation, so that now we live in a world of soaring expectations where we are perfectionists. We expect everything to be perfect. We feel we have to have a perfect body, you know, a perfect family, perfect house, perfect vacation, perfect kitchen, perfect career. Everything's got to be perfect, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're constantly putting up this airbrushed version of our perfect selves on Facebook and social media. And I think that creates also a lot of pressure as well on parents to create the perfect child, right? To create the perfect alpha kid. And so you put all of those things together, and it doesn't surprise me that we've ended up in this extraordinary place where parenting has become a version of product management, product development, and project project management and product development.
And so what's the way forward for us then? What's the way forward as our generation of parents struggle through this new, unique parenting time? What's the sort of way forward for us?
Well, the way forward is, first of all, to look at the facts about what children need, what all the research shows about what they need in terms of time to be bored, to play, not to be scheduled all the time, to have less time in front of screens. The facts are all there in front of us. So I think it's important to get those facts clear in our heads, look at them, and then think, okay, how can I put that into practice in my own life? We have gone through some of the tips and hacks people can do in their own home, but I think it can be very difficult to do this alone, especially in a hyper-connected world where no man, no woman, no parent is an island. We're always aware of what's going on with other people, and I think to slow down and to embrace that more balanced approach to parenting can be a very frightening thing to do. So don't do it alone. You know, reach out to other parents, either through your school or through a local neighborhood chat forum or a coffee morning in your high street, or just something. Find other parents, start your own group, or find other parents that are getting to grips with where we are with parenting and are looking for a way to put on the brakes and take some of that excess pressure out of the equation. And then you start working together, because once you have other people, it becomes so much more comfortable and so much easier to take that first step. If you try and do it on your own, it can be very, very scary and harrowing. So I think that's a way forward. And the good news is that if you're listening to this as a parent and thinking, this is crazy, this is not what I wanted for my children, but I can't take my foot off the pedal, you can, and you're not alone. And it really is just a question of reaching out and finding others who can give you that confidence and help you find ideas and do it together. You know, it's hard for your unscheduled kids, harder anyway, for them to go outside and play alone when everybody else is scheduled in your street. But maybe at the street over, there's a family in the same boat. And if you cast around, you may find them. And next thing you know, your child is cycling around the block and playing outside free range the way children need to play and want to play. So it's kind of taking steps alone, but also together, I think.
Brilliant advice. Could think of nothing better. And it's a great way to build a community and to get back into the whole thing of raising our children with a village as well, isn't it?
I mean, that's such an important part, and it's something we see across cultures, across generations, that notion of it takes a village to raise a child. And we have become so atomized and so isolated now, especially in big cities where you often know your neighbor's car better than you know your neighbors. There may be a whole family of kids the same age as yours, three houses away, and you just don't know them, or you never cross paths because they're going to a different school, or they're all in extracurriculars that don't mesh with your own kids. Mm-hmm. And actually, of course, it is a collective duty and joy raising children together. And I think when people do take that step, when they, for instance, in Britain, there's a big move to close down streets from time to time to traffic to allow kids to go outside and play. I think the movement is called Reclaim Your Streets. It's a website. People are doing it all over the place. And they find it such a revelation. It's such an epiphany to open the doors and not feel like everything outside your front door is a cesspool of drunk drivers and pedophiles. But actually, there are other real people there, families with children who want to go outside and play. And if you just get over that one hump of, say, closing the road to traffic for a day, you make those connections and realize how happy it is and how joyful it is to be outside and getting to talking to people and having a barbecue and seeing the kids running across the street to play. That's the stuff of childhood and can be again if we allow it to be.
I agree. Brilliant. Well, what a lovely way to finish a very interesting chat about parenting. Thank you, Carl. I really appreciate your time. Now, where can we find you? Do you have a website we can find you or get more information?
I'm very easy to find, actually. It's just my website, which is carlhonore.com. And up there, you'll find everything you need to get on the slow bandwagon, if you like. I've got lots of audio and video and blog posts and tons of stuff about slow in every walk of life, not just parenting, but the workplace and everything in between. And lots of links to other groups and organizations that can help you map out your own path to slow. So it's definitely a good starting point, carlhonore.com. And of course, I invite people to write to me as well. I always write back to everyone. I love hearing from people what they're doing and how they feel about slowing down, because this is so much a team effort. And I love to hear what someone's doing in, I don't know, Melbourne or Adelaide, and then pass that on to the rest of the world. And you do find a lot of this cross-pollination and cross-fertilization is a big part of the slow culture quake or slow movement. So do drop me a line and get the conversation going.
Excellent. Great. Thanks very much, Carl. Appreciate it.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Bye.